Please call the case.
Calling case number SCWC 12-115, State v. Vimini. Arguing for the petitioner, Jeffrey A. Hawk. Arguing for the respondent, James M. Anderson, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Hawk and Mr. Anderson. You both ready to proceed this morning? All right. And Mr. Hawk, we'll give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. And Mr. Anderson, you don't require any warning. You'll just keep an eye on the clock. So we will get going right now. Mr. Hawk, please proceed with your argument.
May it please the court. Good morning. Jeffrey Hawk, on behalf of Joseph Vimini, who is not present. He's currently incarcerated at Segaro Correctional Facility in Arizona. My client, Joseph Vimini, was convicted by the First Circuit Court of Class C felony, two Class B felonies, and a Class A felony, and is currently serving a term of 40 years. He will not be freed for 40 years. He's serving this term of 40 years. When he was tried in absentia. He was not present to assist in his defense. He was not present to confront the witnesses against him. He was not present to assist his defense attorney. He wasn't even identified in court. In essence, he was denied a trial. This was a show trial where the defendant was not even there. HRPP Rule 43 requires that a defendant be present for all phases and all stages of a trial. And Rule 43B1 provides an exception to that rule, that the defendant can be tried in absentia, one, when the defendant has voluntarily absented himself, two, prior to the start of trial. The record in this case is clear. The defendant was present for jury trial on a Monday. Jury selection began on that Monday. The jury was selected, and by the end of the day on Monday, the panel was ready. The 12 jurors were there, the alternates were there. The judge at that time did not swear the jury, because Tuesday was his off day. Tuesday he did not have court, so he took a short continuance to Wednesday to begin the trial proper.
Wait, I just want to clarify the record. It's not his off day, right? He has handles other matters on
yes,
Tuesday.
Certainly.
Okay.
We call it down in the trenches the off day, but the judge is
non-trial day.
A non-trial
day. Thank you.
He's doing sentencing motions, that sort of thing. So it's a non-trial day. On Wednesday, the defendant was told on Monday to be back on Wednesday, and on Wednesday he was not there. The defense attorney requested a continuance to get the defendant there, and basically what happened is there were no representations at that time of where the defendant was. Defense counsel didn't know, the DPA didn't know, the court didn't know. So short continuance was granted at that point to try to locate the defendant. They came back at that subsequent date, there was no defendant present. The defense attorney didn't know where he was, the court didn't know where he was. I believe the DPA was able to make some representation at that point that he had heard through the bonds person that Mr. Vimini may have left. And really, that's the only evidence that there ever was about where Mr. Vimini was. There was another continuance, and at some time in about 3 weeks later, jury trial actually started. The judge made a finding that Mr. Vimini had voluntarily absented himself, swore the jury, and began. Now, I think
is it your argument? How much longer should the court have waited? It was almost a month later.
The court should not have waited. The court should have issued a bench warrant.
You mean any time somebody leaves in the middle of the trial, the court issues a bench warrant?
Not any time. Not every time. But in this situation, I think where that defendant doesn't even know about that date, that there's no evidence that he knew he was supposed to be there 3 weeks later.
Well, he knew he was supposed to be there on the following Wednesday.
Correct. So on the following Wednesday, after the jury's picked, it's very simple for the judge just to say, okay, the defendant's not here. We're prior to trial because the jury has not been sworn. I issue a warrant for his arrest, and you hold.
But how long do you wait? I mean, assuming that you're applying the Okamura balancing test where a decision has been made that the defendant has absented himself, and then the court at that point looks at the factors that would apply to making determination as to whether judicial efficiency would require proceeding or whether it's likely the defendant's going to be located. I mean, as Justice Pollack said, there's been a lot of waiting to try to get in contact with the defendant. The bail bond company is working really hard and hasn't been able to get in contact with the defendant. So how long did you think the court should wait?
So I think there should be different standards if the person's in custody or out of custody. But if he's, in this case, he was out of custody, he's not present, and at that point, the court needs to make a determination whether that absence is voluntary. Right then and there, it should try to make that determination.
Is it, and just analytically, do you concede that it's possible to determine that a defendant has voluntarily absented his or herself because they're just out of contact and they haven't appeared for a trial that they understand is going to proceed?
I don't believe that's sufficient. I believe you need some sort of evidence given either by a bonds person or a person who saw him get on a plane and leave.
So as long as the defendant gets away clean, doesn't talk to anybody, then the trial is shut down. That's your position.
I think in this situation that's the correct answer.
But there was more than that, because he had an appointment with the ISC, he had missed that. The attorney had tried all the numbers and had been unable to do that. The bondsman had tried every way and had been unable to do it. And the government, although it may not be substantiated, had a report that he conceded at the airport. All of that looks like, to me, there's nothing indicating that it wasn't voluntary.
Any number of things could have happened, Mr. Biden. What I'm saying is that there needs to be an evidentiary hearing where the bonds person actually gets up there and says, Mr. Bonilla is not here, and these are the reasons why he's not here. These are the places we think he might be, but there was never any evidence of that. The DPA made representations.
Did anybody this is a whole new argument that you're challenging whether or not all the representations that were made. Did the attorney who said that, I forgot exactly what the attorney said, but the defense counsel said they had no contact. Should the defense counsel have been required to testify?
I don't think you should be holding the defense counsel responsible for the presence of the defendant. I think it's the bond company and the DPA working together to secure his presence.
And if we're talking about evidence, and what I'm trying to suggest is that the defense counsel did make a representation. I mean, no one had been able to access or have any contact with the defendant.
That's true. And that could be that he was hospitalized. That could have been that he was arrested by the jurisdiction.
And he eventually was found in Texas, right?
A year later.
So, well, as the Chief Justice said, if you're able to escape the jurisdiction, it falls upon the... And the defendant isn't going to... Who knows where he was? The defendant knows where he was. Obviously, you can't make the... you can't make the defendant testify where you were. How can you make it incumbent upon the state to prove it was voluntary? You have to construe the evidence. We can't find him. His phone was turned off. It's just not that they weren't able to. He turned his phone off after telling people this is the phone number he's at.
Well, we don't know he turned his phone off. His phone was off. But, I mean, without getting to that, it needs to be voluntary, not involuntary. And it could have been an involuntary absence.
Wait a minute.
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I think what you're saying is true. I mean, there does have to be a showing. But in those cases where... there's been involuntary situations where the person's in custody somewhere else. I recall situations where a defendant might get transported. Instead of being transported to the state court, they get transported to Honolulu District Court, or they're in federal custody and somebody hasn't done the paperwork. But in those cases, it would be involuntary. But there's nothing like that at all showing that the defendant was incarcerated or unavailable, not within their own volition.
I agree with that. And I think you'd also have to agree that there's nothing to show that he was voluntarily not present.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
Can't the inference be drawn that, by the way, he was warned there had been an incident in court sometime prior in which the judge had specifically told him, you need to be here, in essence, whatever anyone tells you, when I tell you to be here, you need to be here. So he had been...
There was a prior incident where he was...
Admonished, I guess is how you might put it.
There was basically a motion to revoke his bail. Some investigation was done.
So there's no real question here that there was any doubt in his mind that he was required, or the record would support the conclusion that the defendant knew he had to be there on Wednesday, correct?
I would agree with that.
Yeah. Now, is there anything different about that? Would this case be in any way different in your mind if the trial had, the evidentiary part of the trial had begun? I guess I'm trying to understand. I gather one argument of yours is that absent some affirmative evidence that he left, the trial could not go forward. Is there also a separate argument that you're making regarding the stage of the trial that for some reason, in this case, because although there had been jury selection, there had been no evidence that the court should have leaned towards just basically stopping at that point and issuing a bench warrant? Or would it be the same analysis, in your view, had the evidence already begun?
The end result would be the same, but if the trial had started, in other words, if the jury had been sworn and evidence had started, then I would concede the point that the trial had actually begun. But my first argument, of course, is the voluntariness. The second argument is that his absence needs to be prior to trial. And the trial had not begun because that jury had not been sworn.
But that's for double jeopardy purposes.
That's true. That's for double jeopardy purposes. But if you look, the ICA basically adopted the federal standard as to Rule 43 as to when jury trial begins. And federal rule basically says it starts at the start of jury selection. And that flies in the face of the Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure, and it flies in the face of...
How does that fly in the face of the Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure?
So if you take a look at Rule 43, Rule 43A says the defendant shall be present, quote, at every stage of the trial, including the impaneling of the jury. The rule mentions trial, has to be present for trial, including the impaneling of the jury. So in the rule itself, they're separate. They're not, it isn't even contemplated that these two things are the same. If you look at Rule 24, Rule 24 talks about trial jurors. That's the heading, trial jurors, and that whole rule has to do with just jury selection. The only mention of trial in that rule is that the jurors can take notes during trial. If you look at 24.1, which is in the heading of the conduct of a trial, that section of the HRPP begins with opening statements and goes into evidence.
Isn't there a reading of Rule 43 that the rule is just trying to make absolutely clear that impaneling of the jury is a stage of the trial?
But that's what including means, it seems like. I mean, it says at every stage of the trial, including, which means one of the stages is including the impaneling. I mean, it seems like that's the most natural meaning.
If it wasn't included, it would say at every stage of the trial and in impaneling of the jury, the defendant shall be present, has a right to be present. It would make it a separate thing. Including means it's a part of the trial for Rule 43 purposes.
Then that phrase is not needed.
What about the argument that under your approach, a defendant can be present during jury selection, make a judgment as to how jury selection has gone, and then absent himself or herself, and thereby sort of frustrate the integrity of the trial? That's an argument some of the federal courts have raised. What's your response to that?
First, I would say that puts far too much knowledge and foresight on the part of the defendant. I've worked with thousands of defendants. There's probably plenty. tried to build a rule that works in every possible situation, you're going to erode the rules. You're going to, I mean, bail situations are abused all the time. And yet we still allow people to bail out.
But your argument that it's only for the protection of the defendant, I'd say 43A, presence required, is for the protection of the defendant, but 43B is specifically not for the protection of the defendant. So the rule has this balance that it's, I would say, the protection of our judicial system is certainly a motivating factor behind these rules.
I would say so. I agree with that. If I could go back to some of the other reasons that I believe that a trial had not begun when Mr. Vimeli went missing. The case law consistently states that jeopardy, as the court mentioned, does not attach until the jury is sworn. Under State versus Miller, a jury trial commences with the administration of the jury's oath, and trial on the merits begins when the jury is impaneled and sworn under Sanchez versus State. So I think we're going to be ignoring those other cases if we start to find a different starting point for trial. If we adopt the federal view, what we're going to have is trial starts when jury selection begins. Well, if that's true, does that allow the defense attorney to make mistrial motions one year? When a juror gives a bad answer, and the juror says, I think he looks guilty, I think he should go to jail,
my answer, I think, would be yes. I think that I've heard them when a juror has come out with a response that possibly tainted the whole panel. That's why we do individual voir dire. So I'm not sure that a mistrial motion would be inappropriate during a voir dire part of the trial.
All right. Well, I've never done it. I've never seen it done, but obviously I guess it could happen. And my other problem is when does jury selection begin? Does it begin when I get the cards 2 days before the trial? Does it begin when they show up at jury pool? Does it begin when...
What about a rule that says that jury selection begins when the jury is sworn for voir dire? Because I understand your concern, because I don't think we could say jury selection begins when, for example, a judge sends out questionnaires because they expect, you know, they want to weed out some jurors, prospective jurors.
That would be a bright line, and that would be appreciated by everyone that does the trials.
Did that happen in this case? The jury was sworn for voir dire?
So there's a first swearing where they swear to give true answers, and then they impanel them.
That in fact happened in this case.
They had done that first swearing, but they had not been sworn to render a true verdict, which would be in the trial. If you look at what the court did in this situation, and I've practiced in front of some of you before, and I believe it, that this is a standard practice of the circuit court, is that when you have the jury, and you have your people there, and they're basically selected, and then you're contemplating a short continuance, what the court does is they don't swear. I know this because I've seen it happen numerous times. The court will not swear in the jury. It will wait till that continuance is done, and all 12 people are there, and all the witnesses are there, and the defendant is there, because they know that if they had sworn them before the continuance, and they come back after the continuance and say there's only 10 jurors, well, the complaining witness is going to say, that's going to cause a mistrial. You can't then call in another panel and say, let's add some more jurors.
But Justice McKenna's suggestion is when the jury is first called at the beginning of voir dire, that's swearing. Let's call the impounding one swearing. And Justice McKenna's suggestion is the jurors, as soon as the jurors are sworn to answer truthfully the questions, that would be the trigger point.
That could be a triggering point. I would agree with that.
Mr. Hawk, if I could interrupt you. I mean, the usefulness of the procedure that you're talking about, where the jury is not sworn in until essentially the evidence is ready to begin, is to avoid a finding of double jeopardy, right? But I'm reaching for your view about why it would be useful in terms of determining whether the defendant had voluntarily absented his or herself, why it would be useful to say that that determination cannot be made until after the jury is sworn in, if the jury's already been picked.
Well, if I understand your question correctly, Rule 43 requires that jury, that trial is started. 43B1 requires, in order to have the trial in his absence, the trial has begun. And I think it's, I mean, the case law and the rule seems to indicate that the trial begins when that jury is sworn in and the evidence begins.
Well, so I see your effort to apply that legal analysis, but I'm wondering why, from the point of view of interpreting the intent of the rule, we should see some usefulness in that proposition. I mean, if the jury's already been picked, the defendant's been there the whole time, why then say that the trial hasn't really started? Why interpret the rule in that fashion? Other than, I guess you're saying, a literal reading of the rule, which may be a bit awkward, but is there some public policy reason that would be helpful to look at it that way?
What we want to do is we want to have defendants present for their trials. We want to
right.
have them there. And we only want to say...
But as Justice Pollack said, there's a balancing. I mean, that is not a rule that's insurmountable, right? At a certain point, if the defendant doesn't show up for trial, the trial continues.
Well, I believe in that case, if the defendant does not show up and that's all you have, you still need to make a determination about whether or not that was voluntary, and then you need to apply the open order balancing test.
Sure, that may be, but the fact remains that there is a procedure to proceed with trial if the defendant doesn't appear after the jury selected.
I agree with that.
And I don't understand why we should back up the idea of doing that all the way to the point that the jury has been selected, but, you know, why not apply it there?
Why not say the trial has begun when the jury is first impaneled, when the jury's first?
Right. I mean, it provides a certain amount of efficiency. It indicates that the defendant is on notice the trial is taking place. I mean, there are a lot of ways to look at it as though the defendant has participated, the trial has started, and a critical stage has been completed.
I guess my problem with that is that it doesn't fit with the case law that we've been operating under. And that's that a jury trial commences at the administration of the jury's oath.
Well, if you are applying a double jeopardy analysis, I suppose you could make that point.
I don't think we've had a case. What trial courts need, what defense attorneys need, what the state needs are clear rules that make sense. And it makes sense if jeopardy attaches at a certain point, why not make the jury trial start at that point, too? If you have to burn a jury, you have to burn a jury. In this case, it was a one-day jury selection. If you apply the Okamura balancing test, they had a day of voir dire. The state had to fly a witness in. Certainly, they had costs in doing that and preparing for trial. But balancing that against 40 years in jail and someone basically being tried in absentia, as if this was, you know, some sort of foreign country, and receiving 40 years, I think clearly the defendant's rights won out in that balancing. The Okamura balancing test basically says that the state's interest needs to clearly outweigh the defendant's interest, and that's simply not true. I mean, the state has some invested time, some invested costs, but if we're looking at it from a monetary point of view, the state of Hawaii is going to spend at $30,000 a year for 40 years, $1.2 million incarcerating Mr. Von Mealy.
Well, but there's likely to be a very, I guess you could say, a new expense if it appears that the practice in our jurisdiction is that the defendant, once the defendant successfully leaves the jurisdiction, is going to set it up so that we have to have a whole new trial.
I mean, eventually.
I mean, from your point of view, I assume that what would have transpired under your analysis is the case would have been held in limbo indefinitely until the defendant was somehow contacted or apprehended, and then there would have to be a new jury selected, probably because many of the jurors may have fallen off in terms of being in contact or their lifestyle or new things that happened. Or maybe we'd have to have new voir dire, but you could see it's sort of a new ripple in criminal procedure. What happens after the trial is held in limbo for 2 years while the defendant goes to a different country or travels around and isn't contacted? What do we do next?
Well, if that's the hypothetical, then
So then you start over. Is that the idea?
Mr. Hawk, could you just briefly address the charging issues? I know we're into your 5 minutes, but if you could just give us a minute or two on those issues. And
sure. And our argument on that, on the Cody Amat issue, is that this charge, none of the charges in this case, give the defendant a fair notice of exactly what he's being charged with. I think I put out in the application for that, you know, with promoting prostitution and kidnapping, there's at least four different acts, states of mind, people harmed. It's just, it's all over the place.
Could I ask your help in getting more specific about the manner in which these different acts prevented the defendant from getting adequate notice about the charges? Specifically, there's an interesting analysis in the Cody Mack case by Justice Acoba in the dissent where he points out that where the harassment was charged in two different ways, in essence, the government actually conceded that one of the ways could not be proven, given the evidence. So in that regard, when you look at these five counts, is there a particular scenario or particular alternative that you think could not have been proven given the evidence? I know that's kind of a complicated question because it requires you to look at all five counts, but I didn't know if there was one particular example that stood out in your mind about how the evidence could not possibly match one of the alternatives that was suggested in the disjunctive.
Okay, so in the kidnapping charge, Mr. Bunyan is basically accused of holding a gun to the complaining witness and terrorizing her. And that charge, there are four different ways of reading that he intentionally restrains Wayland with the intent to terrorize her, or that she has the intent to terrorize an unspecified third person. I mean,
who's the third person? Reason. Is that what you're saying? Who's the third person?
Who's the third person?
Could he have, Mr. Vimili, filed a bill of particulars, and did he do so, and if not, why not?
He could have filed a bill of particulars. I don't know that was filed in this case, but I do not believe that would have solved the problem.
Why not? Why couldn't you specify or request in the bill of particulars specification of which of these paths is being charged?
He could have.
Or alleged.
I don't know that he would have got a clear answer from the state. The state typically
Well, then that could be brought to the attention of the judge. At that point, could not Mr. Vimili have said, you know, I really have, Your Honor, respectfully, the answer is inadequate. There's a real question here as to whether it was the complaining witness or some other third party who was implicated. We can't adequately prepare a defense. And then the court could rule at that point. But that is the procedure, at least in felony cases. Wouldn't it be fair to say that's the procedure that's anticipated for clearing up these kinds of uncertainties?
I would agree with that. Okay. But my argument is that it's a notice argument, that it's a due process notice argument, something that should be done in the charging document.
Very well. Thank you very much, Mr. Hawk.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
It. Mr. Anderson, your argument.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Anderson, Deputy Prosecutor for the State. I think the rule 43 is quite straightforward. The purpose of the rule is to prevent a defendant who is initially present at the stage of trial, he voluntarily absents himself from that stage, will not defeat the proceedings from continuing. The safeguard here is voluntarily absents himself from trial. The court in this case, the trial court below, did not rush into proceeding to trial in absentia. The court first determined whether Vinili was voluntarily absent, and that went through several proceedings. He was warned several times. He was told he could not leave the island. He showed up late. He was said, if you don't show up at the proceedings, you know, you're going to be incarcerated. And he understood. He understood he had the right to be at trial. At the motions in limine, that's when he arrived late and he was warned. And then the court gave him his tapis bondi. So he understood he had the right to testify. He would be cross-examined. It was his own right. And he was present for jury selection. Then on the following Wednesday, he was not present at all. And what happened there was a little bit different than what counsel says. Defense counsel informed the court that he had spoken to Vinili the day after trial, jury selection, and said that he would meet with him. Vinili was at his probation officer's office at that time. And Vinili never showed up. Counsel persisted that day in trying to call, and Vinili never picked up. At that point in time, bail was forfeited and a warrant was issued for Vinili's arrest.
So, Mr. Anderson, you're suggesting that a factor that would be a useful factor for the court to consider was whether or not there was a showing by the defendant that he remained in contact with his attorney. And if he didn't remain in contact, that would suggest that he was aware of the proceedings and decided not to be there.
You know, my answer to that, sir, is the two people who would be expected to know his whereabouts did not, his counsel and his bail bonds person. And they didn't, and they tried to contact him unsuccessfully. And finally, I think on 6/28, the first continuance, the first five-day continuance from 6/23 to 6/28, the court even said that one of the bail bonds persons had called him numerous times and she was at the airport with law enforcement people trying to catch him if he tried to escape. I guess they had heard that he was attempting to. And of course, he had not contacted his own counsel by that time too. And so, but yet the court waited a bit, 3 more weeks, and set trial for July 19th. In an effort that, you know, that hopefully he would be found or caught. He had not been. And on that, and counsel again represented to the court, he had made numerous attempts to contact him, the last one being a week ago, and they're unsuccessful. So I guess you could say, no, I'm not sorry, I guess. It's pretty clear he had voluntarily absented himself from the proceedings. There's nothing to indicate he was dead or injured.
Does the state believe that the Okumura test still applies after Caraballo?
You know, I don't know. I really don't know. Because I heard it was applied when he voluntarily absented himself or when he did not. So I'm not really sure. But I'm prepared to argue that anyway. I think the equities are in our favor on that one. I know as to when impaneling, what the meaning of impaneling is, that's kind of interesting. The federal case law from which this rule emanates suggests, like the Bradford case, that impaneling occurs during, it is the process of jury selection. The common dictionary definition also calls it the selection of jury from a panel. So I think this is where the rule emanates, so I think we should look to that, to federal case law for guidance on that matter. With respect to...
You would concede, however, that there has to actually be at least voir dire starting. Because jury selection sometimes does start with the sending, a mailing of juror questionnaires, and the state would not take
no,
the position.
Oh, no, I agree with you perfectly. Okay. Yeah, I mean, they have to be in court. They have to be, you know, administer the initial oath to tell the truth. Yeah, that's the beginning of jury selection, of course.
And what if court is not in the courtroom? Pardon? What if that procedure, what if it's, I'm just thinking of situations sometimes, you know, a judge will have 150 jurors down in the jury room. and, you know, swears them in there and starts questioning because there's so many people.
I see. Well, I'm sure that's the beginning, too, as long as the defendant is present during that time. I mean, that's the key. I mean, you think he would be, or not necessarily, right? Maybe they're brought up and then he's present. That would be, for his purposes, whether he is there for jury selection.
The custom is if they are assembled in the jury pool, the defendant is brought and the oath is done in the jury pool. And in fact, that room serves as a courtroom.
Yes, I was a law clerk. I know that too. I agree. Absolutely. I don't think, you know, the Bradford case makes a distinction with double jeopardy and jury selection. The Bradford court says that to draw the line of formality at swearing in the jury would frustrate the purposes of Rule 43, which is to prevent a defendant from obstructing the proceedings by voluntarily absenting himself. That's one issue. The second point is that they have different interests. Double jeopardy has different protections. This one is just to determine when a person is not present for purposes of trial in abstention. So I don't think double jeopardy has any bearing on this matter.
So you would be comfortable with a test that focuses on or says the start of the trial is the administration of the oath to the jurors prior to jury selection, that they will tell the truth during?
That is the beginning of jury selection, I would think.
And that, in fact, happened in this case, correct?
I would assume the state would take the position we don't need to address the issue with respect to a non-jury trial at this time. I think Kalia might have some language that, you know, suggests it was completely dicta, but suggested that there was a question of whether or not a bench trial had commenced when the case had been called. Yeah. And,
I think
opening statements, perhaps.
That was answered, right?
It wasn't answered.
But in Kalia, inferentially, or almost expressly, it seems to me, it rejected the double jeopardy approach because Kalia said, look, there's a question about whether when trial had commenced. And what Kalia did not cite two cases of the Hawaii, Pohuhina and Ferreira, which specifically say a non-jury trial commences at the taking of evidence. And what Kalia suggested was that instead it cited to this Pennsylvania case, which had also rejected that trial commences when jeopardy attaches, and instead said, look, trial commences when something incidental to the trial started. And so Kalia suggested it could even be the Tachibana. So again, it had backed it up before taking of evidence.
But in this, so you're saying in this case, however, the judge, perhaps concerned about his prior absence, gave Tachibana colloquy during the motions in limine.
No, I wouldn't say that.
Oh, you didn't say that.
No. I just said he did give it, though, at one point, to make him more aware. I was
right.
Pointing that out, because he was then aware that he had the right to testify. If he did, he'd be cross-examined, things like that would happen during the trial. And he was giving up that right as well, you know, because he was aware of those rights. I don't mean to say that he should be apprised that, you know, if he leaves, if he's present and he must be told that if he leaves, trial will be held without him, because that's never been the case. In fact, that's never been in the case in Kalia. In Kalia, I think you have to give him that kind of advisement when he indicates he's going to leave. But otherwise, so I think I don't have anything more on that matter.
What about the charging issue?
I have some stuff on the charging.
Mr. Hawk raised questions about the fact that this charge didn't adequately advise the defendant of what he was being charged with. Could have been restraining the complaining witness. Could have been a third party. Is that meet the test in Cody and Matt?
I think paying attention to the test in Cody and Matt. The test in Cody and Matt is that acts charged in a single subsection may be stated in the disjunctive if they are reasonably related. That constitutes sufficient notice. And the states of mind may be charged in the disjunctive. To count one, kidnapping, the acts were intent to terrorize the complainant or another person. A person. They're just different people. I mean, they're reasonably related, the complainant or another person. Count two, the two acts were the intent to inflict bodily
now,
injury.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you're on count one, and you said that it's clear that two different conducts that are alleged in count one for kidnapping are reasonably related. The conduct being restraining of the person, or the restraining of a third person. So those are reasonably related?
Yeah, because they're different. They're just people. They're yeah.
So if, in your view, there was another person involved,
actually there was
a third
This is just charged in this manner because we did. We weren't.
It would be sufficient to just charge in the disjunctive.
According to Cody Matt, yes, if they're reasonably related.
All right, and you were moving on, I think, to count two, which alleges two types of conduct, right? Infliction of bodily injury or else subject a person to a sexual offense.
Different types of bodily injury, Your Honor. Absolutely.
I'm sorry, what?
Different types of bodily injury, Your Honor.
Okay, so they're reasonably related because they both allege a type of bodily injury.
I would think so.
All right.
Count three, TT. Word or conduct, I think, is reasonably related. Threatens by, you know, by word or conduct. And the acts are with the intent to terrorize or in reckless disregard. It's different mens rea of terrorizing.
In count three. In count three, in terms of the conduct, is bodily injury to another person alleged along with serious damage or harm to property?
No. Bodily injury with the use of a dangerous instrument, sorry.
Okay.
With the intent to terrorize or in reckless disregard, but those are mens rea, so they can be alleged in the disjunctive. They're not acts.
All right.
Okay. Count four is promoting prostitution in the first degree. The two acts there are compelling the complainant by force, threat, and intimidation to engage in prostitution or knowingly profiting from such coercive conduct. So you're coercing a person to engage in prostitution or you're profiting by it.
Is that reasonably related? So being the person who benefits financially versus the person who's doing the compulsion, is that stretching the limits
it's
of reasonable?
It's a little bit more so than the other ones, I would say. But not that unreasonably related, where you would profit from the coercion that's existing. Yeah.
But why is it, in your view, still reasonably related? I mean, I guess you've acknowledged it's a stretch, but why does it not break what we suggested in Cody and Matt?
Because the one act is compelling the complainant by force to engage. The other one is to knowingly profiting by that coercive conduct by another. Another person is compelling the complainant. But so I guess it's in the sense that they're reasonably related, is they both involve compelling the complainant to engage in
the same underlying conduct is occurring.
And finally, the carrying use of the firearm and commission of a separate felony, count five, you have to knowingly carry on your person or have it in your immediate control, or intentionally use or threaten to use a firearm.
No.
Those are all. I mean, you can't even use it unless you're carrying it. So they're kind of, they are very related.
They're related in the sense that a firearm is being discussed with respect to the conduct that is described in three different ways. In other words, there's the use of a firearm, the threat to use a firearm, and carrying a firearm.
They're all types of possession, I would think, Your Honor.
And then would it be the practice of your office, do you think, to continue to charge the actions in count five with the disjunctive as opposed to including the conjunctive?
Yeah, I can't answer that. I don't know.
Do you have a sense of why it was that the conjunctive wasn't used at all in these charges?
Why it was not used? Because I think this is the language of the statute. I think we charge in the terms of the statute, in the language of the statute.
So that would be your test, just whether or not the language of the statute is being...
No. I mean, it can be wrong, I'm sure, as has been proven elsewhere, but...
I mean, the language of the statute was something that was addressed in the...
For instance, in the Lamalu, we had to do the and or between the different subsections.
Right. So when Justice Moon was addressing that issue, although there were two different sections of the statute that were accurately applied, it was his view that it should have been charged in the conjunctive as opposed to just leaving it separate.
Sure. But this is permissible. It comes from one subsection of the statute, and I hope you'll find that they're reasonably related. So.
There's a statement the ICA goes on to talk about, more generally about disjunctive pleading, and seems to state very strongly that disjunctive pleading provides adequate notice. Do you understand that to be breaking, sort of setting out new law beyond what we said in Cody Med, or do you understand that to be read in light of what we said in Cody Med?
Well, I think Justice, Chief Justice ICA's position, right? Nothing more. I understand his point of view that you should be prepared to defend against the disjunctive acts, and certainly if they're in the conjunctive, we're going to try to prove both. So either way, you should be prepared to defend against both acts alleged.
But doesn't that subsection go beyond what we stated in Cody Met?
How so? I'm not sure.
I think we held in Cody Met very clearly that you can charge disjunctively if it's within the same subsection a statute and the acts are reasonably related.
Right.
But I think... following up on the Chief Justice's question, it appears that this section of the opinion suggests that does not constrain it to that rule that we adopted in Cody Met.
Okay. Well, then, I agree with you then. That's fine. If there's nothing?
Nothing further, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Hawk, your rebuttal.
Just very briefly. As to the question of whether the Okamura test applies, case the Okamura test applies, and that's even with the case of State versus Caraballo. I think Caraballo can be distinguished. Caraballo was present there in court. He'd been there for the proceedings. All he was asking for was a short chance to go to his doctor and kind of come back. The court had a colloquy with him, explained to him that he had to be there. He said, "No, I want to go." Essentially, he waived his right to be there for that portion of the trial, and that is fundamentally a different situation than this situation, where there's no colloquy, the defendant is not present, there's no discussion, and then the court essentially goes on and tries him in absentia. Even if we find that the trial has started, and even if we find that he voluntarily waived or voluntarily left, there was no Okamura balancing test in this case, and I think if it's applied in this case, clearly the defendant's rights and the defendant's his presence at trial is far more important and far more needed than any cost of the state.
You know, we had been asking you some questions during your last few minutes of your argument, so if you have anything further to wrap up with Mr. Hawk, feel free to do so.
Mr. Hawk, would you like to respond to the issue of whether the acts that are alleged in the various counts are reasonably related?
So the acts, I mean, whether it's the carrying of the firearm, those seem to be related. The act of terrorizing, however, in the kidnapping, I mean, when you're restraining someone, and then terrorizing this person or this person, I think, then you get outside the realm of being reasonable.
Anything further, Mr. Hawk? at this point. Very well. Thanks to both of our counsel this morning. The court will take this matter under advisement.